Isn't it great when you have something to look forward to, like the latest episode of this podcast, or even better, an amazing Italian getaway? Well, Explore Worldwide's new Amalfi Coast Discovery Tour is a slice of heaven. I'll be telling you more about it later in the podcast, but for now, I'll leave you with this. Their big blue sale is now on, and you'll save up to 20% on Explore's most popular small group adventures. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.
I love the question, what do I love? What gives you butterflies? Is it opera music? Is it scrapbooking? Is it gardening? Is it surfing? Cross-stitch? And if you don't know, try remembering. What did you love before the world told you that it was silly to love it?
Hello, my lovely listener, and welcome to the Big Talk Book Club. It's a special series we'll dip into together each month right here on the Jessro Big Talk Show, where we still skip the small talk, but this time we're diving into the books that really stay with us, the ones that spark big feelings, juicy questions, and honest reflections. This is your backstage pass to some of the world's most celebrated authors, the storytellers whose words stay with us long after the final page. And we're going deeper than just the plot into the ideas, characters, and themes that made me reflect on my own life and maybe yours too. And the best part is you won't just be listening in. You'll have the chance to ask your own questions and be part of the conversation. So before we dive in, let me tell you a bit about the incredible author joining me today. Holly Ringland is an international best-selling author. Her first novel, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, which also happened to be made into a mini-series starring Sigourney Weaver, and her second novel, The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, are books that have gained worldwide acclaim. And her third book is a work of non-fiction called The House That Joy Built. I absolutely loved it, as it's an invitation to find that creativity that burns brightly inside of you, free from fear and shame. There is so much that resonated with me in this book, and I can't wait to share our conversation with you. Holly, I had such big feelings reading your latest book. It's so beautiful, and I think it really touched me because I'm a huge believer in joy. Mm. I chase joy in my life, but there are still times when I will hold myself back. Mm. And what sort of touched me so much about what your words say is you give us permission to go for it, to create. Mm. Why is that so important?
I think it's so important because it is an inherent part of us as humans. Creativity is an inherent part of being a human being. It is the expression of our imagination. It doesn't mean that we need to paint masterpieces. It means that we express ourselves and act from that place of imagination inside of us. And when we do it, it feels good. It feels good because we are connecting to this resource that we are born with that allows us to feel magic, to feel a sense of awe and wonder right from within our own minds, our own lives, our own solo time with ourselves. When we sever ourselves from that, for all the reasons that the world will tell us as adults, particularly as women, that spending time creating in the productivity culture that we live in is not a productive or useful use of our time when so many people rely on us when we have so many responsibilities. And the clincher is if it's not earning us money. So we drift away from our imagination, generally speaking. We can. But then we wonder why we feel that pull or that call when we notice a painting or we notice someone in a fabulous bright outfit on the street. Or we hear a song and it stirs us to tears. And it's because our soul and our imaginations are recognizing the creativity and the expression that we're absorbing. And it's a two-way input-output relationship. And when it's only one way, when we're only absorbing but not creating, it causes a great sense of unresolved and unidentified grief in our lives that we can almost not even know where it's coming from.
And also not even know why it is we're feeling so adrift or almost numb in a way. You say there are times when we sever ourselves from that, from our creativity, from chasing that, looking for that. You did that, didn't you? I mean, you're an incredibly successful author, but there are times when you cut yourself off from that.
Oh my God, I spent years of my life too scared to write. My amazing mum taught me to read when I was three. For anybody that's read my first novel, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, Alice Hart's mum hand wrote words, nouns, and cut them out and pasted them around the house. That was my mum. She made sure that from the time I was born, I was surrounded visually by words. And so by the time I was three, the greatest gift, apart from life, that mum gave me and access to her incredible mind and heart was she taught me to read. From three, I told mum I wanted to be a writer of stories. And then I grew up. As we all know, childhood turns into teenagehood, and how any of us survive that is always a small miracle. And then 20s, 30s, and all through my whole life, up to my mid-30s, I was very aware that there was a voice in my mind constantly asking me to listen to it, and I constantly pushed it away because for various reasons, whether it was internalizing that I wasn't worth using my time to write, that I wasn't good enough, smart enough, that I would never, quote unquote, make it. I didn't even know what that meant, just internalized all that messaging. And then in addition to that, experiencing many different relationships that chipped away at my sense of self and self-worth, I had no courage as an adult, which we need to pursue our creativity. I had no courage to think to myself, now I'm going to sit down and write because I love it. And so the risk of not writing was safer than trying to write. And so I put it away. And I was terrified of it for years and years and would sometimes wake up in my 20s in the middle of the night with these full-on dreams of existential mortality crisis about being older in my life and thinking, I used to want to be a writer once. I really, really wanted to try and write and see what would I write. And I did that for years until I was 34. And it was then that I was so sick of the pain and the risk of not writing that the table flipped. That's when the table flipped and the risk of not writing started to become more painful than imagining taking the risk and letting myself do what I felt I'd been born to do, not in sort of like a destiny way, but it's the only thing about myself that I was any good at. Like my report cards in primary school were not about my fortitude in PE or science. Like my maths and science report cards through my entire schooling was she tries hard, you know, A plus for trying. But when it came to English and writing, the the report cards when I look back at them now that make me laugh is my poor teacher saying, like, I really appreciated her voluntary English assignments that she submitted that actually weren't at all part of the curriculum. I was a wild teen.
Yeah. Well, you loved words. Now, there's so much I want to pick up on in there. First of all, you talk about courage and also fear. Because for all of us, fear does hold us back from reaching inside, touching that creativity. What is it that brings me joy? Mm. Do you ever get rid of the fear?
Not in my experience. Like right now, this is one of the most magical things that's happened to me in the last 10 years, and I'm totally shitting myself.
No, like, you're not. Why? Oh,
but just the nerves and the fear, like that it never, not nothing.
So meaning sitting here chatting makes you feel
terrified.
Wow.
Because there's part of my brain that is like, oh my God, what are you about to say? Are you actually making any sense? It's a constant dialogue. Like, are you going to say anything that lands? Do you know anything? I'm not sure that you know anything. And it is just...
So that inner critic...
That inner critic...
That you write about.
And the self-doubt, the two are bedfellows to me. They're very similar. The inner critic is like 24-hour news. Self-doubt shows up at specific opportunity. So I've learned to manage them, but I absolutely still feel them. And they're both driven by fear. So it's just that, I think it's the price of experiencing the elation and the discovery and the wonder of the unknown and of doing the unknown. So even though I've got all that dialogue in my mind while I'm sitting here with beautiful, extraordinary, colourful you, having the time of my life, and I'm going to leave and be like, Mum, I'm going to go on the phone to Mum. There's still this sort of ingrained accountant fact-checking everything from the place of fear. So in my experience, it doesn't go away. I've just learned how to manage it, and I don't always succeed. I'm totally succeeding right now because while I feel scared, I also feel more than that, really present, grateful. I'm not panicking. And that for me 15 years ago is unimaginable. It was just all fear. So it's, for me, the fear doesn't go away. But the more you dance with it, the more you learn what it's made of.
Oh, what a image. How about that, listeners? Thinking of dancing with fear. Mm-hmm. And that's very powerful because you're taking almost control of that fear.
Yes.
And I think you are so right that the fear never goes away. Mm-hmm. I still get fearful of putting myself out there. But that's almost part and parcel, I think, of being brave.
Yes.
That you feel the fear, but you do it anyway.
You do it anyway.
Because at what cost of not doing it?
You're robbed of the ability to live your life and feel the fullness of your joy and the wonder and awe and bewilderment at what you can become, at how much good you have the capacity to create, offer, feel, connect, share, have in your life. That's the cost, I think.
So for you then, waking up at sort of 34 and thinking, I'm going to do this now. Mm. I'm going to write, truly write. Mm-hmm. What did you have to do? How did you push that self-doubt down? How did you create?
It took, and I wouldn't wish this on anyone, it took watching a family member that I love die to shake me out of how terrified I was to try, to shake me out of finding my way to do it, to sit down at my desk and write. And the way that I did it on the day that it happened was, I remember so clearly, I was home alone. It was about a month after my family member had died. I was with them in hospital when they died, and I'd never been with any being that I love when they died, not human, not animal. So it was my first experience of the honour and the horror and the love and sorrow of being with someone as they died. And it was about a month after that, and I was in a particularly rogue wave of grief. I was home alone, and the person that had died was such a big champion of me as a storyteller and a writer. And the last thing he said to me before he died was, he was never very serious, but on this afternoon, he zeroed right in on me. We were alone in a room and he was very serious. And he said to me, he knew I had my idea for my first novel. And he said to me, you will write this novel. And if you can't write it for yourself, you will write it for those of us who are invested in you. And then the bastard went and died. That's like his classic. He was such a comedian, such a playful clown. And that was his, that I cannot imagine a more fitting sort of way to leave me, really. And so this wave of grief, I was home alone and it drove me upstairs. I was kind of wailing, you know, when it just tears through you. And I was I was suddenly so sick and enraged with the fear, with being stopped by the fear. I was so sick of being stopped by the diminished sense of myself that I had allowed to happen through relationships with other people that had chipped away at me. And I went into my office, and the way that I did it was I sat and I was exasperated, and I had had it, you know, like I was like a mum with myself. I've had it up to here with you. And I thought to myself, what if for 10 minutes, put a timer on if you have to, you don't listen to all the reasons why you're not good enough to do this? What happens if for 10 minutes you let yourself free write fiction? You clear a space in your mind where the volume of all the voices, the inner critic, the self-doubt, it's down. What might have the chance to come through for you to hear? And Jess, I've never won anything. I don't win things. Like, luck is not my lady. I think I won a TV in a Target raffle once when I was 17.
Well, that's not too shabby.
I mean, you know, my mum was a single mum. It was a big deal. But, you know, I wouldn't say I have the luck of the Irish. So this feels like the luckiest I will ever be, because whatever mighty forces conspire to be at our aid in life, I asked myself not to listen to all of the reasons why I wasn't enough for 10 minutes. And in the space that that created in my mind, I took the lid off my pen and I picked it up and I held my pen over the paper. And in that space, I heard and wrote as I heard it. In the weatherboard house at the end of the lane, 9-year-old Alice Hart sat at her desk by the window and dreams of ways to set her father on fire. And I dropped my pen and said something like, holy fuck, here she is. And that's never happened to me in the same way again.
And that, of course, is the start.
First line of The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, that remains, that is the first line. And it was the beginning. It did not mean from that point that it was easy. I had to go through many rounds with fear to write that manuscript. But it was a moment where I asked myself to show up. And the story that I think I probably had wanted to write for years met me there.
And you had to remember that little girl who loved to write and to tell stories.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? You hear people wang on about our inner child your whole life. Perhaps maybe I thought people were wanging on my whole life about the inner child. And then you experience something where, like you say, you reconnect with the kid inside of you, in my case, the girl inside of me, who had her first desk at 7 and who at 14 wrote River Phoenix / Baywatch / Luke Perry Beverly Hills 90210 fan fiction.
Your first novel. That was my first novel. It was.
It was.
You handed it around to
all
of your friends.
I did to my friends. We read it like a serial. It is still not finished. I think at the moment it's sitting somewhere at 300,000 words. I mean, if there's any publishers listening.
But isn't that fascinating? Because there, as a young woman, you're writing and you're not worrying about what anyone else thinks. You're doing it for the joy.
Oh, God.
I'm creating something.
And it was a literal marvel. And it wasn't a healthy ego. It wasn't arrogance. It was more the complete intoxication of there being a blank page. And then if you sit with it and write either by hand on keyboard, afterwards, there's a whole vivid story there. And that was the drug. That was the elixir. So when I was 34 and I had that moment where I wrote the first line of The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, I like to think it feels like that 14-year-old who was so much smarter than the 34-year-old kind of met me in that space and was like, about time.
Here you are.
Here you are.
Where have you been?
Where have you been? And I had been a really scared grown-up. And I very quickly changed my tune about wanging on about inner children. Our inner child is absolutely a thing. God.
But it is.
Of course.
And you write about, in your beautiful book, The House That Joy Built, the importance of play in our lives. And this is for everyone. It's not, oh, I have to be a novelist, so then I have to do this. It's for all of us.
Yes.
We need to get back in touch with play, with our imagination.
Yes. And the reason why I think about this a lot is because we are, you know, we've all heard the saying many times, you can't draw water from an empty well, you can't pour from an empty cup, jug, you know, all of the metaphors. The thing about resilience in us is that it's not, in my experience, a self-topping up, a self-fulfilling resource. It needs fuel. Resilience needs nourishment. And the way that I know to most powerfully fuel resilience is through the joy of creativity. Whether that is making a birthday cake for someone that you love, whether it is putting on an outfit and walking down the street in which you feel yourself, dancing at home, whether the neighbors can hear, it's how we love each other. It's how we sing happy birthday. It doesn't need to be a huge grand gesture and creation of art. Letting ourselves tap into the heart and mind space of imagination and think with colour.
Because you believe, as do I, in the joy that the sort of ritual of adornment and the joy and creativity that that brings. It's not about, oh, a fashion statement.
No.
It's, I do this for me.
For me. It's how we put life back in.
Yes.
Fuel the resilience, fuel the juice. And don't we need it?
Oh, more than ever.
To stay open-hearted, to keep our eye out for creating and connecting and noticing wonder with each other, to give ourselves the act of grace of enjoying, allowing ourselves to do something that makes us feel good. And the other thing about the joy that creativity brings us is that sort of one of the greatest things that I've loved about writing The House That Joy Built is researching and getting my head around the many different types of joy we experience. So there is the euphoric, pleasurable, high as a kite joy, which of course we all live for and is the best feeling. What I find more interesting than that is the joy that comes through vulnerability and connection, whereby we can feel the joy of connecting with each other's humanity and sorrows. And that joy fuels resilience. And I think the biggest thing that has changed the way I live since I've let myself start writing is that by giving my creativity a home in my life, a place in my life to belong, and by giving myself permission to feel the power of the joy that creativity and writing brings me, I have created a home for grief. I've created a place where all the grief that none of us live without can belong. It's where I can always take the things I can't resolve in my life and think to myself, these are experiences and feelings I wouldn't want to wish on anyone else, and I don't want to repeat or experience again myself, but they're part of me and my life, and through creativity, I can make beauty from them. And that beauty is joy. It's all the different facets of joy that I find endlessly fascinating. And creativity is one of the quickest and fastest ways and most powerful I know to connect with it.
And also, it's a very tangible way of shifting and changing how we think about ourselves and the world. And I think that's what's exciting for people with this book, that yes, then I mean, they aren't necessarily going to say, oh, I've got to write the next big novel. Or,
oh, no.
There, you know, there'll be people listening thinking, well, what can I do? How can I shift in my life? What can I do to really find that self that I have pushed away and was frightened about for so long?
I love the question, what do I love? What gives you butterflies? Is it opera music? Is it scrapbooking? Is it gardening? Is it surfing? Cross stitch?
I love cross stitch. I'm a little obsessed with cross stitch at the moment.
I get it. I think for me, that's the most powerful question is, what do I love? And if you don't know, try remembering. What did you love before the world told you that it was silly to love it?
Yeah, put you down.
Put you down.
Or belittled you.
Made you feel ashamed. What did you love? Did you love to dance, to hike, to... What did you love? What made you feel like you were in your body and your life and everything was singing in revelation? What did you love? And if you still can't find an answer, the second thing we have in addition to imagination that is a superpower is curiosity.
And daydreaming.
And daydreaming. We daydream all day long, whether we're conscious of it or not. And we are being creative all day long, whether we're conscious of it or not. So it's staying curious to find out what you love, because you're allowed to love whatever you love without shame. And when we let ourselves do that, in my experience, we meet a version of ourselves we don't know as grown-ups. And that wonder of becoming, of seeing what you are capable of doing, is a life force. And it's contagious. The more you do it and share it with others, the more others start to think, God, what do I love? And it opens everything up at the same time as so generously fueling us to not shut down, to not lose empathy, to not be closed to the world, which just matters so much.
Remember, your next international getaway dream can come true with Explore Worldwide's Big Blue Sail. Their small group adventures allow you to really connect with the culture, not just tick off the sights. Explore Worldwide's expert tour leaders get you closer to the colour of Morocco, the peaceful beauty of Japan, or the hidden gems under the glorious Italian sunshine. And with their Big Blue Sail on now, you'll save up to 20% on Explore's most popular small group adventures. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au, and don't just travel, explore.
And that's what's so glorious about your book, The House That Joy Built, is that it shows us how we can do that, or gives us permission. And that's what I sort of said at the start of our conversation, that that freedom of to say, hey, this is important that I own this and that I say I am worthy of chasing, doing, carving out time for myself to do what it is that brings me joy and that is my creative heart.
Mm.
Of course, it's not simple. It's never easy.
No.
And with your first amazing book, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, there were stops and starts along the way.
That's very graceful, Jess. Thank you. There were, let's call them stops and starts. Yes.
And I found almost in a way sort of reassuring in the sense of, you know, because people might look at you and think, oh, she's this incredible internationally successful author. She's got all of this. You know, she's had a miniseries with starring Sigourney Weaver, or, you know, all these sorts of things. But when you were writing your first novel, you submitted the first three chapters to a writing competition.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
There was one of the big publishers in Australia was running a writing competition where you submitted the first three chapters of your novel in progress. And if you won, you got a book deal. So for a aspiring writer, that was the drug, the catnip, the wildest thing I could imagine. So I wrote the first three chapters of The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, and feeling particularly plucky and brave, which felt like hell, because feeling like being brave never feels good. It feels like fear. It feels...
But it is fear.
It is fear.
They're combined.
They're all, again, they're dancing. Fear and courage are dancing. And so I found my courage pants and pulled them up to my eyeballs, and I polished up the chapters. I submitted them to this competition and I waited. And it wasn't that I thought, it was more that I dared to hope. What if? I let myself wonder, what if? And then I got the auto reply rejection email. And it didn't mention my submission. It didn't mention The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart. It just said, thank you for submitting. You have not been successful. You know, best wishes. But the implied sense of failure that my three chapters weren't good enough hit me like a demolition ball. And so it felt crushing, but I remember it also felt very clearly like it was a test to push me to see whether or not I was going to be toppled or if I would just get back to work with Alice Hart and keep writing the chapters. So I finished the manuscript, and fast forward a few years later, when Lost Flowers went out on submission to publishers in Australia to see if it would be published, the publishing house that had rejected the three chapters weighed in heavily in the auction that took place to buy the book for publication. And it still makes my face hurt to think about that. It makes my legs hurt, everything, my cheeks are hurting. Because I can't bear the pain of thinking about what would have happened if I had taken that as my sign that I should stop trying. If I'd taken that quote-unquote failure of the first three chapters not doing anything in that competition as the sign that I was not good enough and I should stop trying. It's a really interesting lesson it taught me about my perception of failure, which is that I didn't fail, I learned. And I couldn't have been tested and learned how committed I was to Alice Hart had I not gone through that. And look, I want to roll my eyes at this as well. There are many days where I'm like, no, it's just a failure. I don't want to learn anything.
Yep, I bet enough. There's enough lessons.
Yes, lessons, no. But it is nevertheless true that I thought I failed, and really I learned one of the most valuable lessons I think I've learned in my life.
And tied up with that as well is the other stumbles and roadblocks along the way. Procrastination.
Oh my
All
God.
Of us oh. have procrastination.
Yes.
And it's not though, because I procrastinate terribly.
Yeah.
But I'm not lazy. It's not laziness,
no,
is it?
No, it's such a misconception that procrastination is laziness. It's more complex than that. It's about managing and regulating emotions and impulses. And I love what James Clear says about this, who is the author of the Stratospherically Successful Atomic Habits, in which he talks about procrastination being about essentially we have two selves when it comes to procrastination, our present self and our future self. So at the moment, I have left my writing desk at home and put on my glad rags to come and see you. And I am in the process of writing my fourth book, which is my third novel. And so my future self knows that I am writing my third novel. My future self knows that there is going to be a reward and an achievement that comes when I finish writing the book. So my future self knows that that dangling carrot at the finish line is there. But the problem is that to get there, I need my present self. And my present self doesn't love the idea of having to wait for reward and gratification at the finish line when I have to go through the drudgery of doing the work of feeling vulnerable, managing that, feeling fear, managing that, turning up at my desk, reminding myself that I'm there because I love it and it brings me joy. All of that stuff that we have to go through. My present self is kind of thinking, according to James Clear, we're kind of thinking, hi, where's my reward? Where's my, I'm really happy for my future self and all of her, like, you know, gongs and glory. But what about me in my pants with no bra on and hair that hasn't been washed in a week that has to do this right now? And the friction between the two causes a stalemate. And what can happen is that the pain of starting is harder and more unbearable than the pain of just doing the work and being in it. It's a little bit like stage fright. You're sick to your guts before you go out and do the recital. But once you're out there, you're like, it's not that bad.
Yeah, what on earth? Why did I spend so long?
Yes.
You're so right.
Exactly.
And you share in the book as well things that have helped or things to help us all get a bit out of that sort of stuck, come on. The artist's date.
Oh.
I love that. Share that, please, okay. What that is all about.
So anybody who has read Julia Cameron's The Artist Way, which is very much quite a Bible for a lot of people who have been in what Julia Cameron calls creative recovery, which is being an adult who remembers we love to create and then needing to go through the stuff that makes it hard to recover our creativity because we have to look at what has stopped us from creating, and that can be vulnerable and painful. So Julia Cameron has written this book, The Artist's Way. It's a 12-week program. And so part of the program that people might be familiar with is that you write pages every morning, stream of consciousness, you just get the pen moving. And also then she introduces the concept of artist dates, which sounds really great on paper. Clear time for yourself to go out on a solo date with just you, to take your inner artist somewhere and woo them. Do what your inner artist loves. On paper, amazing. Deeply drawn to it. Love it. Sign me up. The reality of my first artist date, when I was 34, this was before I wrote Lost Flowers, was I threw my all into it like any date with anyone I was excited about. I shaved my legs, Jess. I washed my hair. I like put on my best.
You're ready.
I was ready. I put on my best undies. I put on my best outfit and I caught the bus. I was in England at the time. I caught the bus into Manchester where I was living to go to the art gallery, to go to the stationery shop because who doesn't love pens and notebooks? And I was kind of flying like giddy, great. Got off the bus in Manchester and it was like someone, it was that ice bucket challenge that went around a while. It was like someone had tipped a bucket of ice water over me. I just mentally collapsed. All my joy about taking myself on my first artist date, I couldn't tell you what caused it. I couldn't tell you what the moment was or why. I went to the art gallery and there was just this voice in my head like, what are you doing here?
Do you think it was expectation that you were putting too much pressure on yourself for it to be some
absolutely
revelation? And
I'm sure
of imposter syndrome.
I'm sure it was expectation that what I was going to go into the gallery and look at a painting and be struck down by an epiphany and write a novel while I was sitting there from page 1 to 500. Like, my expectations are not half-hearted. And I just remember feeling absolutely crushed, like a bad date that you've had enormous hopes for and you don't even know why it's let you down so much. And I just felt utterly deflated. So I went home and then I tried again a week later. This time I did not shave my legs. I put a beanie on. I didn't care what my hair looked like. And I went into town and I calmed down. And I thought, just stay with yourself rather than turning your back on yourself and abandoning yourself the minute you feel vulnerable and uncomfortable. Just stay with yourself. So I went back to the gallery and I walked around and I started to pay attention to the daydreaming that we were talking about that's happening all the time. And I heard my thoughts consciously. And I was looking at a painting by Waterhouse and I was thinking, how did he paint that water to look translucent green? Then I found myself thinking, what did his studio look like when he painted that? Then I found myself thinking, what could his female contemporaries at that time have painted if they weren't feeding the men and raising the babies? What would she have painted? What story would she have told? And I was creating and telling stories without even realizing it. And then I had a feeling like, don't look it in the eye.
Don't get too excited like, about this.
I think I'm having an artist date and it's working. Don't look it in the eye. So I went down into the art gallery gift shop because, my God, who doesn't gift shop? And I bought a notebook and a pen and I went into the cafe and I bought a pot of peppermint tea. I sat at a table by myself and I wrote down everything I could remember thinking while I'd been looking at the paintings. It was glorious. And it, like all of us know, it paved the way. The minute you do something once and you experience how it makes you feel, you remember that and fear loses one pinky grip of a hold. I artist dated the shit out of myself around Manchester after that.
Well, you gave yourself permission.
Yes.
And you could exhale just a little bit, which leads me to, we asked our listeners for some questions for you.
Oh, how beautiful.
And there's one from Christine and she asks, are there any habits or rituals that you've developed as a writer that helps you stay grounded, especially when creating emotional or complex narratives?
Oh my God, Christine. Are you watching me at home with my Christine? What an incredible question. And the answer is absolutely yes. There are a couple of things that come to mind. I pay attention to when I need to rest. Knowing when I should rest versus when I should force myself to get to work because I'm procrastinating is a real skill and ritual in itself. But like I said, right now, writing my next novel, I allow myself now at this point in my career the utter pleasure of doing everything to bring this story into being in a grounded, authentic way where I keep the noise of publicity and publication that I know is coming, which is such a privilege to be a working artist. But it's not good to bring into the room with you when you're creating. So the way I keep myself grounded with that while I'm writing my novels is I feed my senses. Vanilla flavored coffee? Yes, please. Favorite pajamas on the couch with the fluffy blanket while you're breaking down this really knotty chapter? Yes, please. There's an internet yoga teacher that everyone loves named Adrienne. She does yoga with Adrienne and she offers, this is not a shameless, this is not a plug, but she offers free yoga classes and I've done many with her online. And she says, find what feels good. So around the writing feeling good and cultivating and teaching myself how to make the process of writing feel good, I make sure that my body and my mind and my mental health feel good. And that's how I think I tie it all together. So it's through those sensory comforts, through knowing I don't have to suffer to create. We don't need to listen to dead white male poets talk about the fact that if you are not suffering, I mean, bless Byron, you know, he did write some incredible poems, but we don't need to be in existential angst and physically uncomfortable and suffering to really enjoy and make art, to create, whatever that means for us. And giving myself comfort in creativity was a real game changer. If everything hurts at your desk, go and write in bed. It's so obvious and simple, but it seems something that is so easy to forget.
But it's right there in front of you. Our final question from another listener is, if you could sit down with one of your characters for a cup of tea, but I'm going to say vanilla-flavoured coffee, who yes, would it be and why?
Oh, my God. What a question. I'm going to go with what comes to the top of mind because I'm not great with favourite questions. Jess, we could be here at 5 p.m. this
it's
afternoon.
It's like, do you have a favourite child? No.
That's exactly right. But also, I mean, I feel like you probably know me well enough after this time together to be like, and dear listeners, we were there until 5 p.m. And she kept on saying, and then. I'm just going to go with the first character that comes to mind. And in my second novel, The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, it's a story about Esther and her big sister, Aura. And I would really love to have a cup of vanilla coffee with Aura while she's in the Faroe Islands and to have a chat to her about joy and grief and love and joy and how important it is to stay open-hearted to all of them. Oh, that could make me cry. That's a beautiful question.
Can I join you for that vanilla coffee?
Absolutely.
As well, please.
Absolutely. There's so a space for you always.
Thank you for sharing your heart, your joy, your creativity with us, Holly. It's going to sit with me for a long time and I want to incorporate it in my life. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope by listening to Holly, it inspired you to tap into your creative self. And as Holly said, it's not about writing the next big novel or painting some incredible masterpiece. It's really about getting back in touch with doing what you love and giving yourself permission to do that. You know what I'm going to do? Take myself on an artist's date. And I hope you can think of doing something like that as well. So wish me luck as I decide whether, I don't know, I go to an art gallery or maybe a movie. It's quite fun going to the movies on your own, but something that is going to fuel my sense of artistic soul and spirit. I'm going to do that. Do you think you might do that too? Now, Holly's latest book, The House That Joy Built, there is so much in there. It's not a handbook of sort of tips of things to do. It's more some questions and some overall ideas about what you can do to get back in touch with that creative side of yourself, away from all the fear of judgment and what will people think. And Holly shares a lot about her writing experience in this story. So I really recommend you getting your hands on it. And if you'd like to find out more about Holly, her Insta handle is Holly Goes Lightly. Isn't that just divine? Or her website is hollyringland.com.
Okay, now it is time to explore, because now it's time to tell you a little bit more about Explore Worldwide's new Amalfi Coast Discovery Tour. Imagine lemon groves, little cliffside villages, staying in a family-run hotel where the pasta is definitely better than anything you've made at home. Even better, it can all be yours for less, with up to 20% off in Explore Worldwide's Big Blue Sale on now. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.